So welcome, everyone. It's good to see so many people here. So it's interesting with this book, Karma by Trolog Rinpoche. It's like for the last couple of years, I really wanted to begin doing some teachings around death. And I kept getting a lot of negative feedback because people said, well, you're doing open house in the fall. You want all these new people to come and then you're going to talk about death. That'll turn them off. So it's very interesting. You know, I keep thinking about this. And then I remembered this book, Karma, which I studied a couple of summers ago. Michael Fagan had a group at his house. And I think you were there too, Megan, right? And I really liked the book. So we picked it, and then I realized that some of the material was really difficult. So that's true, and like any Dharma teaching, it's important to just be open and read it and think about it, and then realize as you experience more on the path, you can keep coming back, going back to material that seemed really confusing, and the second or third time around, sometimes it's easier. So tonight, I thought rather than sort of pushing ahead, we could have more of a discussion and more chance to ask questions and really bring out what is confusing or difficult. And I really focused, I think there's a couple parts to this. I just want to give a brief introduction. And mainly I ask people to look at Chapter 4 on the Bardo teachings again. I'll be focusing more just briefly on the Bardo of this life. And then Elise is going to talk about something called the Four Reminders, and particularly the reminder about death and the, you know, kind of immediacy of death and the importance of contemplating death. And Michael Levin wrote something also on Bardo teachings, and Erica's going to jump in. So it's really a group presentation or discussion. You know, we don't really have a tight plan here. So just to begin, all right, I'll have to start with a joke that you brought it up. Okay, so at the library, we did an introduction to meditation there, and right before I started the talk, the librarian handed me this piece of paper. And she says, it said, a Buddhist monk goes into a Zen pizzeria and says, make me one with everything. He pays with a $50 bill. The cashier hands him his receipt. The monk asks, where the rest of his money is. The cashier calmly replies, change must come from within. So it's good to start laughing. If we're going to talk about death, we have to start with a joke. But I think actually this is an interesting starting point, because what are we doing anyway? We are actually working on the way we see the world, and through our meditation practice and our study of Buddhist teachings, we're opening to different ways of seeing and thinking about our world. And this is change comes within. It's a gradual path, and it's considered an unfolding. And that's why, actually, you probably see a lotus as being a symbol of Buddhism. And that's because a lotus grows in the mud. And so that's our cloudy, confused thoughts. And you're from India, and you've seen a lot of those. They're beautiful. They're everywhere. And then it comes up onto the surface of the water, and the lotus opens one petal at a time. It just opens. And that is really a good visual image for what happens when we begin to study Buddhist teaching and work with our own mind. Yes?
Something to add to that, because of another perspective of lotus root, is that it's a root, mm-hmm. and it grows horizontally and then comes up. And the fact that it's a root, but it's also in water.
Yes.
There's an interesting kind of beautiful tension between that. Mm-hmm. So.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Yes.
And then it needs the mud.
It needs the mud. Right.
It needs mud to grow.
Right. So that's our confusion and our confused mind. We don't throw anything away. We actually work with it and transform it and really see our own enlightened potential. So Buddhist teachings actually ask us to explore and not to believe. So when we teach, we're not saying this is something you have to believe and carry with you. We're saying really chew on it and think about it, explore and ask questions. So that's really your job, not to believe anything, but actually to question. So when we talk about bardos, bardo means intermediate or intermediate stage or the time between, in between, especially if we're focusing the bardo on this life, we think about birth, we think about this period that we're alive, which we call life, and then we think about death. And that's sort of our kind of surface view of how it is. Life is just everyday life. It's living. But actually, if we explore that a little more deeply, what we see is that there's a lot of birth and death, birth, experience, and death throughout every day, throughout every moment, throughout every breath. So actually, what at first seems like, oh, life just going on, if we penetrate that a little bit and look really carefully, we see that there's multiple things happening, and they all have a beginning, a middle, and an end. So you could see that, in fact, instead of something fixed, there's a flow. And there's a process going on. And it's things are always changing. So fundamentally, even though this joke is kind of simple, change must come from within. The deeper teaching, or well, maybe it's not deeper, but the real essential part of Buddhist teachings is that everything changes. And that's really what we're talking about in terms of the bardo teachings. That there's the bardo of this life, which is birth, life, and death. There's the bardo of dying and death. So that's the bardo, which is from the point of when the beginning of the dying process happens to the moment of death. That's a period. There's a transition period there. And then right at the moment of death, there's something called the bardo of luminosity, where there is potential at that moment, it's said, to actually wake up from our cloudy, confused way of seeing things. That because we drop our attachment to our body, which grounds us in a very earth level way, that there's a potential for the mind to experience this awake, penetrating, open space. Now that bardo of luminosity, we actually have that potential to experience that at any point in our life, even wherever we are. But we miss those moments where there's that possibility of just being in that open space. So that's the third one. So the bardo of this, there's four main ones that are discussed in this chapter. The bardo of this life, the bardo of dying and death, which is one together, the bardo of luminosity, and the bardo of becoming. So the bardo of becoming is that period where we can actually we take on what's called the subtle body, the subtle bardo body, and then there's a period of moving towards a new life or a rebirth. So that's like a thumbnail of how it's described. And these teachings are very old teachings and very profound. And obviously there's a lot more to say there. But fundamentally, what is said in this chapter, especially at the end, death is not to be feared, and the after-death experience can be utilized for our own benefit. So the fact is that, and from a Buddhist point of view, death is a wonderful opportunity. Death is actually an opportunity to wake up and to actually have a chance to move into another lifetime that can also give further opportunity. And that's why it fits in with karma. So there's a loop here. At first you could say, why this topic? But if you look at the teachings on karma, karma means, what does karma mean? Does anyone remember?
Action,
right. So karma's action. So the action that we take in this life actually lays the ground for what's to come in future lives. So action is an important transition point or a key here, that our activity of virtuous actions can manifest further, and things that are confused we have to process and awaken from, you could say. Basically, the teachings say that the death isn't just a standalone event, but actually, even you could look at the time when we go to sleep as a time when, similar to the time of death, where slipping into this other world where we're not that conscious, where there is a moment of luminosity right there, but we miss it, and then we go into this dream state, which is another kind of activity that's going on. So you could say that's we move more into a kind of a rebirth of another kind of whatever we imagine we're doing during our dream state, and then we come out of it. So I don't really want to take any more time, and I'm sorry that seemed a little bit rushed, but I think what we want to move into, and we'll have a chance for more discussion, but I want Elise to have a chance to talk about the four reminders.
So, the four reminders, and Michael wrote them out two different ways. So, the top one is from this really neat book, The Four it's sort of funny how they wrote reminders. And
Ers.
He's a fellow who lives in Florida now. He was a student of Pema Chodron, so he was at
Panlop Rinpoche. Too.
And Panlop Rinpoche, and was at Gampo Abbey for a couple of years, and talked some about that. And he said he really was interested in the four reminders and worked on, while he was at Gampo, this book. And then when he came out, he didn't do anything with it. And then he looked at it again and he goes, oh my God, I just wrote the same thing everybody else already wrote. And what I really want to write is something that's really accessible to someone who's not like a heavy-duty Buddhist. So it's really, he like said, how can I rewrite this so someone could get it without having to, go to Buddhist classes for 3 years? Like, they could just get it. And so that's that top part there where he just sort of says, here, you don't need to know anything special. This is it. And so, I'm sort of partway into this, halfway through. I finished the second reminder. I have two more reminders to go. His name is Dennis Hunter.
It's on here.
It's on here.
So there are actually two sides to this sheet. So there's the first part, what Elise will be presenting from Dennis Hunter, the four reminders. And then below that is another way.
I'll talk about
you're going to go.
So it's this book, but it's really a neat book. And
you said yours.
No, not Dorsa. She was very nice, but it wasn't her. It wasn't her. So I actually have been reciting the version that Michael printed at the bottom every day before I do my meditations. One of the things I do, like the Four Dharmas of Gampopa, the Refuge Vow, this, and some other things. And when I read the second one, so I'm going to say it just and sort of show. I go, second, the whole world and its inhabitants are impermanent. In particular, the life of beings is like a bubble. And when I come to this, death comes without warning. This body will be a corpse. I make a point of touching my body as I do that every time. To think about, like, really this body, and I sort of try to drive that home. At that time, the dog will be my only help. I must practice it with exertion. So I've been doing that for a long time. And at Christmas 2017, my mom had had flu, had very bad flu, so she'd gone to the hospital, and then she was at a rehab center for like a week or two because she wasn't ready to go back home yet. So I went up to visit her, and I was there. I usually visit her at Christmas. This was right at Christmas. Of course, she's like, I feel better. I want to go home tomorrow. And I'm like, Mom, tomorrow's Christmas. There's nobody here to discharge you. You just get to stay an extra day because you're here. And she was in a shared room. And when I came in, my sister was there, and she said, woman next to Mom is dying. I'm like, okay. And there were people visiting her, sitting vigil with her, and singing to her and doing all, playing music. And Christmas Day came over after lunch, and this woman was resting, still breathing. And my mom was doing her favorite thing, which was she was sitting up in a recliner with her Kindle on her lap and taking a nap. That's one of her favorite things. So that was her way to nap. She'd do that. And so I walked in and I thought, wow, this is a real opportunity to practice contemplating the life of beings is like a bubble. Like, I'm sitting in this room with this woman dying and my mother, who's just recovered from being very ill. And I sort of sat with that. It was just really interesting to just sit. And he actually has in this book that he has contemplations to do, and one of them is about that, the life of beings is like a bubble. And I'm trying to think what he says. He's really cool. Is that you can imagine that at the moment you were born, somewhere an hourglass timer was turned upside down and the sands of time began to slip inexorably away. The blessing, or curse, depending on how you look at it, is that you cannot see the hourglass. So you have no idea how much sand remains in the top of the hourglass. Even if you still have most of the sand you started with, time is slipping away just the same and will be gone sooner than you think. Once the timer starts, there is no pause or reset button. Reflect on the inevitability of your own death and the deaths of everyone you know. So it's sort of very, this was not what I did because I didn't have the book then, but I just sort of, noted, like, that I'm sitting with this woman who I never met, I never spoke to because she wasn't alert when I was there. And I was there, so I thought, there's those charnel ground practices where you go and sit with all the body parts, and I thought, well, this wasn't quite that, but it was kind of, a similar kind of sense of being right there with death that you got invited into, because that's what you got invited into. And then first Thursday of April last year, I was not at this group. I was sitting with my mom, who was at that point dying. And she died the following night. And she'd had a stroke, so she was not responsive and was just in bed. And we had decided not to treat so that she was going to die, that was coming. And it was just this very interesting, very sad experience to be with her, because you're so the practice was just to be there with her.
Yeah.
and sort of sit and see, you know, what happens. And one of the things that happened for me is that I finally, when, you know, she did die, and I was in the room with her, and, you know, I hugged her, and then my siblings weren't there, they were nearby, so I called, and they came back, and by the time they got back, she was, you know, cold. She was really dead. And I was like, oh, people really die. Yeah. This body really will be a corpse. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of the sudden thing of like, I had said it, I had done mm-hmm. this whole activity to convince myself this was the true thing. I did not believe it until that moment. Yeah. When I saw that, when I touched her, when I even happened, we finally told the people, oh, we're done, we're leaving. And so they went in, and then I went back in, I realized I'd forgotten something. Mm-hmm. And they were already had the bag that they were going to remove the body. I was like, oh, she's really a corpse now. She's really still my mother, and she's a corpse, you know, in this space. And it was just like, oh, really, really, really. Because those of you who've seen her or have seen pictures, she and I look alike. This is her shirt. I have more. This might be my shirt. I don't know which one it is, but we had matched shirts. We had matched faces. We had matched voices so that if I answered the phone at her house, people just talked to me as if I were her. You know, that, oh, that's going to happen to me. And it's that piece of, you know, for me the experience is you can hear the Dharma over and over. You can recite the chants over and over. But it's somehow life has to take you to the place mm-hmm. where a lesson makes sense to you. And that's kind of, for me, that was that experience. And this, you know, his, Dennis Hunter's way of saying it, don't waste time. I had planned that I would do this meditation program up at Wonderwell, the Marga program, and I'd spoken to the Liz Munson about it. I said, well, I don't think I'll do it now. I think I'll do it when I retire in 2 years because I'm really busy now. And I don't really have time to do that. I don't know how I would fit that in. When my mother died, I thought, you think you know how long your hourglass is. Like, you have no idea. Right? So I was like, no. And I signed up. But you know, just that sense of not getting it, and then it makes sense, some of these lessons. And that was just a very, very interesting experience with this.
The great epic in India is called Mahabharata. You know, it's sort of, and it begins, I don't know when it begins, but a sage comes on stage and asks, what is the most wonderful thing in the world? Meaning, what doesn't make sense, you know, why? And the answer is that death is all around us. Nobody ever thinks they'll die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, that's, you know, it's true. And it's, and you know, it's, we don't think it'll happen to us. And at the same time, we're afraid of that.
When you told that story the first time, and it sounded so real, all I could think when you were sitting there, but I won't be able to breathe. So you slip the bag.
You know? Oh, interesting.
How, I mean, what will happen? They can't zip the bag. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, I mean, it's like ridiculous. Obviously, you know. But it sounded so scary.
Yeah.
Because we don't talk about it. This society is so death phobic. They don't talk about it. I had just a few weeks ago, I had a death date with my mom. So she's 86 years old and she's advanced COPD. So she has maybe a year or two in her mind left because she gets pneumonia a couple times a year. So along with her birthday that I wanted to celebrate, I went out to celebrate her future death. So we got all dressed up in red and purple. We went out for breakfast at Bloody Mary's. And I wrote her eulogy and took notes on what she wants to go to whom. And we talked about her end-of-life desires. Then we went out and picked out her burial plot, the green burial location. Mm-hmm. And they had a number, and she goes, which one should I have? And I said, feed the tree. So she's gonna be buried right beneath the tree. Then we went out for martinis. It was a bit of alcohol. And we just did a life review.
Wow.
And we just talked about her life. And the end of the night when I dropped her off, she said, she took my hand, she said, this was perhaps the most beautiful day of my life.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And she's just so grateful to be able to talk openly about her death with somebody. And just to be able to be present with a loved one. And it's sad to me to know that I'm going to be without her at some point. But to be able to give that, be able to talk openly and be sad with each other, that's okay. We don't do that here. And it's such a shame. Because it's the most powerful way to connect with each other. It's our most vulnerable. We're going to die. When we can talk about that with each other, we are opening up some part of us that is terrifying and wonderful at the same time.
You know, when we went to the Bardo meditation retreat a couple Saturdays ago, I heard about something that now is going on. It's called Death Cafes.
Yes, I'm going to be running one up in Bedford.
They're all over the place.
Yes.
And you sit down and you talk about death and have some tea.
We also do death over dinner. We come and have dinner. And you have to have food. That's the community part of it. But yes, it's an amazing opportunity to just talk to strangers about death.
I should mention, and I didn't put it in the announcements, that this coming Saturday at the Boston Shambhala Center, there's a program about Buddha's funeral service. It's from 10 to 12. There's no charge. You can sign up online just under Boston Shambhala Center. And Megan and I are going to go. If you're interested in knowing what it is to put together a Buddha's funeral service, if you want that for yourself or want to know that, you're welcome to attend. But we'll also have information. That's why we're going. That's why I'm going. You may already. Well, you have. Well, we'll find out.
On a lighter note, there's a new book by Roz Chast. Has anybody heard of this?
Yes.
It's called Why Don't You Write My Eulogy Now So I Can Correct It?
Yeah. Well, she's actually. That's what I did for my mom.
It's about her mother. Yes.
It's also graphic
novels.
Well, because I think she was the
Patricia
artist.
Patricia Marx, and she's the cartoon.
Because she actually, her previous book I have is Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? It was her experience trying to have these conversations with her parents. Like, what would you like on your only child? And like, can we talk about something more pleasant? You are going to die. Like, no, we could just.
That was a dream.
By the way, if you're on Facebook, connect with me because I run a Facebook group called Death Talk. Mm-hmm. And I have uploaded tons of starter packages on how to have this conversation with your parents, with your children, with your spouse, with your doctor. There's just all these questions. You can write them down and hand them, or you can actually have this discussion with people. Also covers how to talk with people who have Alzheimer's. So each one is a package. And I also have a power of attorney form, blank, and healthcare proxy.
Very good.
Lots of really good stuff.
Yeah. And next week, Megan's going to lead the class on Chapter 6, Fear of Death. I forget the first part that says, but it's basically, so that'll be good.
I work in hospice.
Yeah, Megan runs hospice.
I have a different kind of story.
Okay.
I'm just going to tell you briefly. Roberta knows, knew my mother, and my mother had Alzheimer's, she had actually told me she didn't want me, before she's kind of new, and she told me she didn't want me to try to take care of her. This was before she had, and then she went downhill. And the finale, she was in a unit in a nursing home, and for whatever reason, she had a stroke. Right? So she's in the hospital, and then they were sending her back, and the doctor says to me, your mom probably won't live 4 days. So my mother lived 24 days, something like that, 22, 24 days. So, the first 4 days, I'm like, there every moment. Yeah. But then it was the ninth day, the tenth day. And it was so much like my mother, she went to a beat of a different drummer. Yeah. And it was, you know, no doctor was going to tell her what to do. Right. She was going in her own good time. And I had to say that it was hard. But then we went back to about the 18th day, and no, you know, they were giving her fluids, and then no fluids, and no food.
Right.
And I was like, isn't this is like my mother. You know what I mean? Nobody's going to tell her what to do. She's going to do what she wants, at least of all me.
Right.
Don't spray the tomatoes. You're poisoning them.
Yeah.
The truth is they can't predict time of death until about 24 hours.
Yeah.
So anyone who tells you have X amount of time left, they're guessing. Okay? In all of my experience, until it comes to about the last 24 hours, it's all guesswork. Okay? So any doctor who says that, sorry.
But thank you for talking about witnessing your mother's body.
Yes.
And then the fragility or the, you know, the emptiness of the body. It made me think of when my grandmother died, and I was in my early 20s, and I had been very close to her. And I remember it was like I might as well have been a child. I felt like that at the funeral. And I remember going up, and they had laid her out in the coffin. And I need to touch mm-hmm. this body. Mm-hmm. And to touch her cheek and her face, it was just so, that reminded me so much of that. It's, yeah, it was cold and hard and, you
waxy,
know.
It almost waxy.
Yeah.
And you said,
it's like, I just need to know, where are you? You know, it was really powerful. Mm.
Children often do need to know, and yeah. we shelter them from that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's sad.
Similar experience to you, as you did. And I was actually there when my mom passed away. It's 5 months ago now. And yeah, I actually found it very comforting to be with her while she was dying. I mean, the nurse was there, and you know, they were sort of calling the shots, so to speak, but you know, with the breathing changing. And it just, I had this, I don't know if I shared this here, but almost the image of, it was weird, but of like putting a baby to sleep. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I was sort of by being there, just, and I told my son, you know, shortly after about it, and he said, "Oh, that sounds really scary." And I said, "No, what? I mean, it was the opposite of scary. It just felt right. I mean, being there felt peaceful that I was able to be there. I mean, not in any intellectual way that oh, I was glad I was there, but just it felt comforting to be there at that time." So.
I wonder what's the what they say about like the use of just medication or drugs during when someone is passing. I'm thinking like my mother had terrible restless leg syndrome, and, you know, thrashing all over the place, and she was very vital because she had a stroke, but she was very healthy, and it took her quite a long time to die, but they just had her very medicated. Mm-hmm. And
was that her request?
Well, she didn't want to. She probably could have been put into rehab, but her request was not to do that. But I don't know about her request. You know, I think she probably would have chosen to be, you know, let out of pain or whatever, you know, to kind of. But it was, it absolutely was not a comforting feeling. Mm-hmm. You know, she was just so, like, you know, just a vessel in some way, just 200%
under heavy doses of meds. You know, so it didn't feel right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's something.
And even with that, she was thrashing and all.
Yeah.
That?
Well, they had to give her so much medication because she was so active.
Yeah.
It was terminal agitation. It's not uncommon. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so. You know, just and like I said, she did have what's called restless leg syndrome, which means that, like, even at night before she passed away, her legs would just keep her legs still.
When
she was healthy, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
So yeah, I've just kind of, you know, and then I think about my father-in-law, who he just kind of crawled into bed. He was older, you know, and it was a beautiful death. You know, because, you know, every once in a while we give him a little sip of wine, and he kind of went back down again. He had a little bit of morphine, and he slipped.
But a little bit.
You know, I mean, it was really a beautiful way to go. You know, he just, and everybody kind of would go in and visit him and talk to him, and, you know, and very, very different than what my mother experienced.
You know, I've learned for myself to let go of the idea of a good death. I really have no idea what kind of death I'm going to have. And I'm okay with that. And I'm trying to be even more okay with it. Because I've seen a lot of different deaths.
Yeah.
And people may have in their mind, I want this kind of death.
Yeah.
And
or it should be this way.
I hate to tell you, it's a crapshoot if you're going to get it.
Yeah.
So probably it's better to go in with, I'm not really in control of this, so let's just do this.
Right.
Which
let's
is
with
really
this.
The truth.
Like, yes.
Those birth plans, too.
Birth
plans. Yeah. The birth plan was shopping. Oh,
yeah.
You don't know.
It's way coming in and the way going out.
Yeah. You just, you know, baby's heart rate is disappearing.
Wow.
And you don't want the cesarean, but you want the baby, so.
Yep. You better do it.
That's right.
Did you? Or where were we?
It was interesting with my mom. One of the things that happened that I was incredible. I'm still incredibly grateful for is that she was had the stroke where she lived in Vermont. She was ambulanced to a hospital she'd been to, like, probably been an inpatient there at least 20 times. And so my sister had been there to help her move. She was supposed to move down here, like, 2 days later. My sister was there, went with her to the hospital, and, you know, was like, what am I supposed to do? And the medical staff said we could send her to a bigger hospital and they could try to do things. And we know your mom, and that's not what she would want in this situation.
Wonderful.
And that every time they spoke to us, they, you know, presented, you know, you can do these things, but this is what your mom would have liked, and this is what we know, the, you know, what the different outcomes could look like for you. And they never, like, pushed, like, you need to do stuff, and, you know, and so they really gave us space for that, to let her go, which...
It's unusual for hospital staff to admit that. That it's okay to...
That it's okay. Yeah, well,
usually it's like, go, we can do this, we can do this, we can
well,
do
they
this.
Could, see, they really, they were such a tiny hospital, they could do nothing.
Yeah.
And
but that they even, that they said that it was okay to do nothing.
Yeah.
That's
oh, no,
the
they,
unusual.
They consistently said that.
Like a home, in the way you describe it. I mean, it was a hospital of less than 30 beds, which were not all full.
Right.
So it was like this little family that all knew each other. So it was not
real.
What I think of as a hospital.
No, it wasn't. It was such a tiny hospital. It really was people who knew her and were able to let her go and to be with her and to be very kind, you know, to her. Which, yeah, I know. Like, that's, like, in some sense, you know, I don't think there's parts of it I'm very sad because she wasn't cogent. We couldn't. It's not clear that what we said to her she heard. You know, which is how it goes. And when my father was dying, he had very advanced dementia. And we went to visit him and talked to him, and our stepmother, who none of us liked for a lot of reasons, turns at some point. She goes, "You know, he doesn't understand what you're saying." We're like, "You know, you don't want to say to her like, we're not that dumb." It's not about him, actually. You know, it's about us. But, you know, but that you know, the opportunity to be with her and to know that, you know, in some ways, she wasn't forced to suffer more than she had to, and she was treated well, was, you know, a great kindness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, you don't get to choose. There's so much you don't get to choose.
It's not just death,
but then, like Emily says, the change comes from within, that you say, okay, here's the situation we have. My mom had a stroke. She's not going to move here to live near me. She's not going to do this. She's not going to do that. And we went up right away, and then my sister was going to stay, and it wasn't clear. They said probably a week or so, but they didn't really know. And I came back here, and then at some point in the week, I said, I'm going to go back. And I went back, you know, and happened to be there. But it's sort of, you get to choose. You know, that's the action part. Right. You get to choose what you do. You don't get to choose what you're given. You know, you have these, you imagine yourself going through life and controlling, I'm going to do this and then this will work this way. And every time, almost, you're like, I'm going to do this and this will happen. You're like, ha ha, no it won't. You know, I'm going to do this and then, oh, this happens. Yeah. And so it's really, you know.
I believe that is so important that we get to decide how we respond.
Right.
You know, that's what we get to do.
What do you mean by that?
How we act.
Yeah. You mean respond to what's happening?
To whatever happens. Whatever happens, you know, this is what I'm given.
Yeah. How I feel about this, that comes from me. That's my choice.
I just had a revelation, which had never occurred to me before when we were talking about this, because when I was 17, my mother had cancer from a while before that, but the hospital had sort of a special room that was away from the rest of it in a way. There was an elevator, I remember, and then the room where they put someone who was dying. And my brother, who's older, and my two younger sisters were told to sit on the bench, and I was led into the room with my father. Now I know why they're so resentful of me, because I was the one that went in. Mm-hmm. I never even remembered that.
Wow.
Yeah, so I was there. Not she had already died, but the neighbor had been with her when she died, but they weren't allowed to come and see her. They never got in the room. You said that about children, and that's what prompted that memory. Mm-hmm. I literally forgot that. That's so interesting. And then you see the patterns that are set up in a family when those things happen.
Yes.
And it's not your, you know, it wasn't my fault. I didn't, you know.
You didn't say only me.
I didn't say only me. I'm the boss. It's very interesting what happens then, the pattern.
When my goddaughter was dying right before her first birthday, Marin was 6 years old and wanted to go see her.
Right.
And I brought her. Yeah. So I brought her to Children's Hospital, and so we spent the day with this little baby girl who was dying. Yeah. And then she went with me to the funeral.
Wow.
She needed to. She wanted to be there. Mm-hmm. And she asked to be there. And it turned out to be very good because her mom needed Marin to be there and gave her a big hug. Mm-hmm. She just needed to hug a child.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm wondering how much you found that people die when someone leaves the room. This has been, you know, experience.
Yeah.
I mean, my brother stayed with my mother forever. Yeah. You know, walked out of the room to get lunch, and she left. And my friend's mother, and
We tell people to tell them you're leaving, because sometimes they need you to leave so they
come back. Yeah, that's what I...
So tell them, I'm going out for coffee, or I'm going home tonight, I'll see you in the morning.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if they die and you weren't there, sometimes it's because they needed you to do that. My dad needed that. He needed us to leave so he could die. It was 2 hours after.
So one other thing I did is I kept calling Megan, going like, now what about this? What about this? And she told me about this. And so my mom's last day, they gave her morphine. It was interesting. Afterwards, the person who was treating her came in, held her hand that still was responsive, and said, Sandy, if you're in pain, squeeze my hand. And she goes, oh, she squeezed my hand. Which afterwards I thought... Maybe she never squeezed her. Right. We didn't look and just check. So they were giving her morphine, and she said, you know, sometimes the morphine will make that, you know, sometimes the first dose, that could be it. So we're like, okay.
You mean they'll go out?
They'll go then. And then, so, okay, no. Mm-hmm. And then I said, oh. And we were sitting there and talking to her and holding her. And then I said, my friend said, maybe we need to leave her. Oh, Mom, we're all going to leave the room. So we went out of the room and, like, said 15 minutes to come back in. Oh, she's still here. Okay. What's the next thing? Because it really was just like, we're going to play with it. And then even at some point, they came in and they'd had little patches they'd put on because they weren't, after the stroke, they didn't feed her or give her fluids or anything. Patches just, I think, for the secretions that build up. And at some point they said, do you want us to come in and suction her? I was like, oh, because she's uncomfortable? No, because the sound. I said, no, that's fine.
It's done for the family.
I said, no. If she's okay, then that's fine. We'll make it through. But it is kind of that piece of just like, this thing is happening. We're not controlling almost any of it. And we're having to control what we can deal with. And it was just sort of, okay, we can just...
Was she with hospice?
No, this was just support from people. I mean, it was sort of to the extent... She literally actually, partway through the stay, was switched from being a hospital patient to a nursing home patient in the same bed.
Wow.
Because I got this bill that said she... Something about being discharged from a nursing home. I said, she never left the hospital. Are you sure? I said, I'm really sure. Like, she didn't move.
Yeah.
Anyway, so they, you know, they somehow...
discharged and rehabilitated.
Yeah, well, it was whatever, but it was just this interesting thing that she was in this place and that happened. But it is that you can just think about, like, how am I going to deal with this really not the situation I wanted? And that shows it in a big way, and the truth is, every day, you know, we get the situation we didn't want. You know, I had a student who just wouldn't listen to me today, and I was about ready to smack, and I was so angry at him. I was like trying to think, like, what really cruel thing could I do? And I was so furious, and I was like...
Our Buddhist.
I was like so beyond Buddhist. Like, I was just like, oh my God. I can't remember what they were, but they were really cruel, heartless, painful things I wanted to do. This kid, I was so irritated. And then, of course, somebody else said, would you like me to talk to him and ask him to apologize to you just because he really was? I said, sure, whatever. And she got him, and he came in, and he goes, I'm really sorry that I was rude to you. He walked away, and she goes, I know he didn't mean it, but at least he said it to you. Just like that. Okay, I won't kill him today.
There's two different kinds of suctioning. I mean, you know, sometimes they're just getting the secretions out of their throat.
I asked her what it was, and it was not simple. And I said no.
Okay. I mean, the other thing is, you know, you go up the nose.
Roberta. I asked her, and it was clear that it was invasive.
Yeah. But the little suctioning in their mouth is just not.
No, no. This deal. Was.
That's like.
It usually isn't much in the mouth going on. It's what's going on down here.
You don't want the invasive. Yeah.
No.
Just if they're just clearing up what's in the back of their throat, that's not a big deal, really.
Yeah.
There's the Stephen Sondheim song, A Little Death. Do you know it? It's from Music.
Every day a little death.
In the heart and in the head. It goes on. It's just like... It's about somebody just submitting to what is. Mm-hmm. And it's... Yeah. And so to, you know, that we're all in this kind of arising, dwelling, and dissolving, mm-hmm. like moment by moment, minute mm-hmm. by minute, exactly. is to, you know, what you are saying of these, like, vital to remember to be present as best as one can in each moment, which is so, like when you were saying about the incident with your student, I had a few of them I was just dealing with. They were similar, and it's like I, it's easy to forget, it's easy to, you know, reify that somehow this is permanent and forever.
That's why we call it buttons when they push.
Right, exactly, right.
So actually, you know what, I'm going to end with this poem by everybody's favorite, Billy Collins. So this one is called Picnic Lightning. My very photogenic mother died in a freak accident, picnic lightning, when I was 3.
Wow.
From Lolita. It is possible to be struck by a meteor or a single-engine plane while reading in a chair at home. Safe drop from rooftops and flatten the odd pedestrian, mostly within the panels of the comics, but still we know it is possible. As well as the flash of summer lightning, the thermos toppling over, spilling out on the grass. And we know the message can be delivered from within. The heart, no Valentine, decides to quit after lunch, the power shut off like a switch, or a tiny dark ship is unmoored into the flow of the body's rivers, the brain a monastery, defenseless on the shore. This is what I think about when I shovel compost into a wheelbarrow and when I fill the long flower boxes, then press into rows the limp roots of red impatience. The instant hand of death, always ready to burst forth from the sleeve of his voluminous cloak. Then the soil is full of marbles, bits of leaf like flakes off a fresco, red-brown pine needles, a beetle quick to burrow back under the loam. Then the wheelbarrow is a wilder blue, the clouds a brighter white, and all I hear is the rasp of the steel edge against a round stone, the small plants singing with lifted faces, and the click of the sundial as 1 hour sweeps into the next.
Thank you.
What was that called?
What?
What was the title?
Picnic Lightning. It's from a book called Picnic Lightning.
Oh, okay.
And I'll share it with the group. I'll send it out.
Okay.